This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of 2 Chronicles. Now here's Pastor Sandy in 2 Chronicles chapter 3 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
The wings of the cherubim were 20 cubits in overall length. One wing of the one cherub was 5 cubits, touching the wall of the room, and then the other wing was 5 cubits, touching the wing of the other cherubim. One wing of the other cherub was 5 cubits, touching the wall of the room, and the other wing was also 5 cubits, touching the wing of the other cherub. The wings of these cherubim spanned 20 cubits overall. They stood on their feet, and they faced inward. The wingspan of these two cherubim filled the Holy of Holies. Their bodies must have been facing forward while their faces turned back toward the ark. Revelation chapter 4 tells us that there are four living creatures, or cherubim, around the throne of God in heaven. It's interesting that there were also four cherubim in the temple. Now, where do we get four? We've just talked about two. But you also remember that there were two that were made onto the mercy seat that covered the Ark of the Covenant. Therefore, there were four cherubim in the temple, just as there are four cherubim in heaven today. The cherubim, of course, in the temple were reminders to Israel that though we never worship angels, we always worship with angels. For we join in their praise, and they join in our praise as we worship the grace and glory of God. Well, the next few verses bring up more questions than they answer. Verse 14 tells us, "And he made the veil of blue, purple, crimson, and fine linen, and wove cherubim into it." In 1 Kings, rather than a veil, we're told of a four-paneled olive wood door that separated the holy place from the Holy of Holies. So which was it? Was it a cloth veil, or was it an olive wood door? I don't know. Perhaps it was both. Also, he made in front of the temple two pillars 35 cubits high. 35 cubits, 52 and a half feet. 1 Kings tells us they were cast in bronze and they stood at the entrance to the holy place. And the capital that was on the top of each of them was 5 cubits. He made wreaths of chain work as in the inner sanctuary and put them on top of the pillars. And he made 100 pomegranates and put them in the wreaths of chain work. Now the capital was an ornamental feature that sat on top of the pillars. Sort of the equivalent to our crown molding. You know, you put the crown molding up to kind of give you that little fancy flair, you know. That's kind of what the capital was. At its height and pillars, it along with the 35-cubit pillars, the pillars rose to 60 feet, 15 feet above the roof line. But here's another problem. 1 Kings 7 tells us that these pillars were 18 cubits high, not 35 cubits high that we find here. They were about half the height mentioned here in 2 Chronicles. And so what's the deal? Well, it could be that both pillars were actually cast as one pillar, 35 cubits long, and then cut and rounded off. That's a possibility. There's another possibility. It could be that the 18 cubits in 1 Kings was just the pillar, whereas the 35 cubits included all of the ornamentation that was on top of the pillar. Or it could be that there was a very rare transcription error in the text that we possess here. For the Hebrew letters that denote the number, and you know, numbers in Hebrew are actually letters. The Hebrew letters that denote the number 18, Yod and Cheth, look a lot like the number 35, which would be Lamed and He, which was the H. See the H and see the CH? Not a lot of difference between the two, are there? A smudge, a scribal error could account for the discrepancy, which brings up an even larger question. Does this mean that our Bibles contain errors? And the short answer to that is no. That's not what it means. The original manuscripts of the Bible were inerrant without any error or mistake. The problem, though, is that we no longer have the originals, or the autographs, as they're called. We have manuscript copies. Now, we have some very old copies that get us real close to the original. We also have lots of copies that allow us to check, you know, back and forth between manuscripts to check if they're on any discrepancies. And amazingly, all these old copies and the many copies that we have of these manuscripts that we possess, most are nearly identical. The copies are in 99% agreement with each other. You see, the Hebrews to whom God entrusted the writing down and the transcribing of the Bible, they did an extremely effective and exact and faithful job in the transcription of the text of our Bibles. In fact, in 1947, a famous discovery took place. The Dead Sea Scrolls were found. And the Dead Sea Scrolls provided amazing validation of the Old Testament's reliability. The scrolls contain copies of the Old Testament 1,000 years older than anything that we previously possessed. And the Dead Sea Scrolls proved that the Bible you hold in your hand is essentially the same Old Testament that was read by Jesus. And in the 1% of the text that does differ, like here, none of the discrepancies impact any significant doctrines. It's usually just numbers or spelling. And does this erode my confidence in the Bible? No way. As a matter of fact, it makes my faith more realistic. The preservation of the copies of the Bible on which we depend today have been a partnership between God and man. Because man is a part of that partnership, small errors are possible. But since God is involved, our mistakes can never undermine His plan. Well, verse 17. Then he set up the pillars before the temple, one on the right hand and the other on the left. He called the name of the one on the right hand, Jachin, and the name of the one on the left, Boaz. Jachin means he shall establish. Boaz means in him is strength. And the pillars that stood outside the temple were vivid reminders to the worshiper of God's faithfulness and God's power. And these are reminders to us of the temple that Jesus is building today, the church. For in Matthew 16, verse 18, Jesus said, "I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." Jesus pointed to his faithfulness and to his power. Today, God dwells in his church. We are his temple. And Jesus is building a strong and a glorious church that will bring his people together and that will bring God glory. Chapter 4 begins. Moreover, he made a bronze altar. 20 cubits was its length, 20 cubits its width, and 10 cubits its height. 30 foot square by 15 feet high. This bronze altar was the barbecue pit. It was where the sacrifices were offered. And then he made the sea of cast bronze. Now this was the basin where the priest would wash before they entered the temple. In the tabernacle, it was a laver. It was a small basin. But in the temple, it's called the sea because of its size. It was much larger. Remember, the priesthood had also grown in number, and therefore a larger bowl was needed to accommodate the crowd of priests. It's interesting that in heaven, there's also a laver, because heaven is the real thing. The temple is just the model of heaven. And so we find a laver in heaven. It's called the glassy sea, the sea of glass. But instead of the saints washing in the sea in heaven, they're standing on it. For in heaven, there's no more sin. There's no more need for cleansing. Therefore, what we washed in on earth, we stand on in heaven. Verse 10 sizes up the sea. 10 cubits from one brim to the other. It was completely round. Its height was 5 cubits, and a line of 30 cubits measured its circumference. And under it was the likeness of oxen encircling it all around. In other words, the bronze sea sat on the back of 12 bronze oxen. 10 to a cubit all the way around the sea, the oxen were cast in two rows when it was cast. It stood on 12 oxen, 3 looking toward the north, 3 looking toward the west, 3 looking toward the south, and 3 looking toward the east. The sea was set upon them, and all their back parts pointed inward. The oxen were cheek to cheek. It was a handbreadth thick. And what would you imagine would be a handbreadth? The width of your hand, correct. And its brim was shaped like the brim of a cup, like a lily blossom. It contained 3,000 baths. Now, not literally the water you would use on 3,000 baths, but the bath was a liquid measurement. 1 Kings 7 verse 26 tells us that the sea held 2,000 baths. Here we're told it contained 3,000 baths. It could be that the capacity was 3,000 baths, but it was usually filled with less, just the 2,000. Remember, too, Chronicles was written after the Babylonian captivity. And possibly they were using a different measurement, a Babylonian measurement here, whereas a Hebrew measurement was used in Kings. The Babylonian bath was smaller. A Hebrew bath was a little shy of 9 gallons. A Babylonian bath was 6 gallons. Either way, the bath held a lot of water, around 18,000 gallons. The Bronze Sea was twice the size of the Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain baptismal pool, and it was 7.5 feet deep. He also made 10 lavers and put 5 on the right side and 5 on the left to wash in them such things as they offered for the burnt offering. They would wash in them, but the sea was for the priest to wash in. You didn't want to wash the meat and wash your hands in the same location. So the priest washed in the sea. These lavers that were on the side of the, you can see them there, on the side of the temple, that was where they washed off the meat portions before they sacrificed them to God on the brazen altar. And he made 10 lampstands of gold according to their design and set them in the temple or in the holy place, 5 on the right side and 5 on the left. He also made 10 tables. These were the tables of showbread, and placed them in the temple, 5 on the right side and 5 on the left. The tabernacle, remember, only had 1 lampstand and only had 1 table of showbread. And Solomon made 100 bowls of gold. Furthermore, he made the court of the priests and the great court and doors for the court. And he overlaid these doors with bronze. He set the sea on the right side toward the southeast. This is in the outer court now. Then Huram, Solomon's Phoenician friend, made the pots and the shovels and the bowls, all of the utensils, all of the implements that would be needed in the service of the temple. And so Huram finished doing the work that he was to do for King Solomon for the house of God. The two pillars and the bowl-shaped capitals that were on top of the two pillars, the two networks covering the two bowl-shaped capitals which were on top of the pillars, 400 pomegranates for the two networks, 2 rows of pomegranates for each network to cover the 2 bowl-shaped capitals that were on the pillars. He also made carts and the lavers on the carts, 1 sea and 12 oxen under it. Also the pots, the shovels, the forks, and all their articles Huram, his master craftsman, made of burnished bronze for King Solomon for the house of the Lord. In the plain of Jordan, the king had them cast in clay molds between Succoth and Seredah. And Solomon had all these articles made in such great abundance, and the weight of bronze was not determined. Solomon spared no expense on the temple. And thus Solomon had all the furnishings made for the house of God, the altar of gold, and the tables on which was the showbread, the lampstands with their lamps of pure gold, to burn in the prescribed manner in front of the inner sanctuary with the flowers. And notice the temple was adorned with flowers and with pomegranates and with palm trees. And why? It's because the rabbis believe the temple was a restoration of the Garden of Eden. And therefore it had the pomegranates and the palm trees and all of the garden aspects to it. Solomon also ordered the making of the lamps and the wick trimmers of gold, of purest gold, the trimmers, the bowls, the ladles, and the censers of pure gold. As for the entry of the sanctuary, its inner doors to the most holy place, and the doors of the main hall of the temple were gold. Now you remember back in chapter 3, a veil covered the doorway into the Holy of Holies. But here and in 1 Kings, we're told that a door separated the holy place from the Holy of Holies. And so it's my assumption that there must have been both there, a veil and a door. And of course, both symbolize Jesus, as does all of these implements used in the temple. Jesus is the door to God. Hebrews talks about his body being the veil that was torn so that we could enter into God's presence. I wish we had time to go through all of these different implements and furniture and all the different aspects of the temple and talk about how they portray Christ, because they do. I encourage you to go back and get the CDs from the Tabernacle Study and back from 1 Kings, where we talked about all these issues. Chapter 5. So all the work that Solomon had done for the house of the Lord was finished. And Solomon brought in the things which his father David had dedicated, the silver and the gold and all the furnishings. And he put them in the treasuries of the house of God. Now Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the chief fathers of the children of Israel in Jerusalem, that they might bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord up from the city of David, which is Zion. Now remember, the city of David sort of set southward on Mount Moriah, below what we call the Temple Mount. And thus they brought the Ark from the tent that David had erected, you know, further down the mountain, and they brought it up the mountain onto the Temple Mount to be installed in the temple. And therefore all the men of Israel assembled with the king of the feast, which was in the seventh month, or the month of Tishri, which was the holy month. For during Tishri, the Jews celebrated their three fall feasts, the Feast of Trumpets, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and the Feast of Tabernacles. And so all the elders of Israel came, and the Levites took up the ark, and then they brought up the ark, the tabernacle of meeting, and all the holy furnishings that were in the tabernacle. The priests and the Levites brought them up. Also, King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who were assembled with him before the ark were sacrificing sheep and oxen that could not be counted or numbered for multitude, probably far more than the 1,000 that he had sacrificed back at Gibeon. Then the priests brought in the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord to its place, into the inner sanctuary of the temple, to the most holy place, under the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread their wings over the place of the ark, and the cherubim overshadowed the ark and its poles. And the poles extended so that the ends of the poles of the ark could be seen from the holy place in front of the inner sanctuary, but they could not be seen from outside, and they are there to this day. Now Ezra must have been speaking of the time of his sources, not his day, because the ark was absent from the second temple built by the post-exile Jews. Now, Ezra does comment on the contents of the ark at the time of Solomon. Nothing was in the ark except the two tablets which Moses put there at Horeb when the Lord made a covenant with the children of Israel when they had come out of Egypt. Hebrews 9, verse 4 says that at one time the ark held three things: a jar of manna, the rod of Aaron that had budded, proving his authority before God, and then the two stone tablets on which were written the Ten Commandments. By the time of Solomon, the jar of manna has disappeared, the rod of Aaron that had budded has disappeared, and the only thing in the ark are the two tablets. What happened to the manna? What happened to the rod? No one knows. And it came to pass, if you know, let me know tonight after the Bible study. And it came to pass when the priests came out of the most holy place, for all the priests who were present and sanctified themselves without keeping to their divisions. And the Levites, who were the singers, and all those of Asaph and Heman and Jeduthun with their sons and their brethren, stood at the east end of the altar. There they were before the altar. They were facing the temple. They were clothed in white linen, having cymbals, stringed instruments, and harps, and with them 120 priests sounding the trumpets. This was the grand opening of Solomon's temple. The priests carry the ark into the Holy of Holies. They exit the Holy of Holies, and now the worship team strikes up praise to God. The band starts to play. This is an exciting time. This is a glorious time. The aroma of the sacrifice wafting from the bronze altar. The priests all gathered around, people praising and worshiping God. This is the grand opening, the inauguration of this great temple that David had dreamed of and that Solomon had built. Indeed, it came to pass when the trumpeters and singers were as one to make one sound to be heard in praising and thanking the Lord. And when they lifted up their voice with the trumpets and cymbals and instruments of music and praised the Lord, saying, "For he is good, for his mercy endures forever." What's about to happen? When we praise God, what can we expect? Psalm 22, verse 3 says of God, "You are holy, enthroned in the praises of Israel." In other words, God loves to inhabit and dwell within the praises of his people. When we praise God, he shows up. So what do you expect is about to happen here? God is about to show up. And that's exactly what happens. That the house of the Lord, was filled with a cloud, so that the priests could not continue ministering because of the cloud. For the glory of the Lord filled the house of God. The glory of God, the Shekinah, as the Hebrews called it, filled the temple with this thick, dense smoke, like a cloud that had rolled in off the ocean. The presence of God became so intense that no priest could carry out his priestly duties. All the work came to a screeching halt. All people could do was to bow down and to worship God. My friend and Bible commentator David Guzik, he identifies this cloud of glory as the cloud that led Israel through the wilderness. The cloud from which God spoke to Moses from Mount Sinai. The cloud which God, in which God met Moses and then other Hebrews down through their centuries. The cloud that filled the tabernacle. The cloud from which God appeared to the high priest at Yom Kippur. The cloud that Ezekiel called the brightness of God's glory. The cloud that overshadowed the womb of the Virgin Mary. The cloud that covered the mountaintop at Jesus' transfiguration. The cloud that received Jesus into heaven at his ascension. And the cloud that will display the glory of Jesus at his second coming. That was the cloud, the glory cloud that filled the temple of Solomon. The glory of God now dwelling in his temple. That's my desire for our church. That the glory of God will fill this place, fill this church. That the glory of God would be seen in our lives. That the love of God, that the grace of God, that the power of God, the glory of God would so be seen within our relationships, within our love for each other, that the world would stop. That activity would come to a screeching halt and they would look and say, "My, how they love each other. How God dwells in their midst." Isn't that your desire?
Thanks for joining us today on Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams, as he continues in the book of 2 Chronicles. Pastor Sandy is the senior pastor of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain, in Atlanta, Georgia, where he brings you messages from the Bible, book by book and verse by verse. Just as you're hearing in these messages, life can have its challenges. We want you to know that you don't have to go through it alone. If you have questions about Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain, or if you're in need of prayer, please call us. Our number is 770-736-2828. Again, that's 770-736-2828. We'd love to hear from you. Let us help you work through the trials of this life and help remind you of God's truths that are there to help you each day. To learn more about this ministry, head over to sandyadams.org. Once again, that's sandyadams.org. While you're there, check out Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain under the About tab. We invite you to join us this Sunday. We have services at 9:15 and 11:15 a.m. More details can be found online at sandyadams.org. If you're looking for additional resources, check out Pastor Sandy's books at sandyadams.org. Our time with you is up for today, but we'll catch you next time right here on Sandy Adams Radio.